Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Support for this podcast is provided by Subtruck Law. Revolution Recap thanks Subtruck Law for their support of our show, local independent media, and their mission of bringing unbiased truth. Revolution Recap would also like to thank 6 Point Builders for their support. 6 Point Builders are builders of fine custom homes in the Boston metropolitan area.
Welcome to another episode of Revolution Recap, part of the Believe Network. We're coming to you after the New England Revolution fell 2-1 at the last place, Colorado Rapids, falling out of second place and missing a chance to become just the second team in the league to clinch a playoff spot. The result came after a tumultuous week that saw Clint Pea replace Richie Williams as interim head coach and both Shari Joseph and Dave Vandenberg leave the coaching staff, among lots of other things that we will get into later in this podcast. I'm Sean Donahue today, joined by Hayden Bird of the Boston Globe. Hayden, how's it going?
It's going pretty well, and it's good to be here.
You know, we've got a lot to talk about today. I think this week we will start with the game. Before we jump into it, I wanted to quickly mention our sponsor. Football is back, and BetOnline is your number one information source for all your sports wagering info and all the up-to-minute stats, news, scores, and matchup breakdowns. Get the latest game odds, spreads, and totals from the NFL, college football, and, of course, soccer at your fingertips with BetOnline's real-time updates on statistics, news, and odds. From week one all the way to the college football playoff and Super Bowl, BetOnline gives you the best football promotions and contests available anywhere online. Head to their website today or use your mobile device and get in on the action. Remember to use our promo code BLEAV, that's Believe, BLEAV, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, where the game starts. Hayden, like I said, lots to talk about here. I think we'll start off with our key takeaways from the game. We didn't do that last week, but this week I think we'll go back to that format. Let's get right into those. Of course, they are brought to you by our friend at the Rebellion Supporters Group. Be sure to check them out at Any Rebellion on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, and their website, anyrebellion.org. I believe they still have spots open for their foot golf tournament at Four Kicks in Norfolk on October 7th, with a portion of the proceeds going to breast cancer awareness. So please sign up if you haven't yet. With all that, Hayden, what is your key takeaway from this one?
So my key takeaway, and again, with the very, very big asterisk that we're going to get into all of the full week of drama at the club later on, but just my key takeaway from the game was just the lack of defensive depth that the Revolution have not maybe directly costing them in this one, but just sort of manifesting in a general way that led to defensive breakdowns and issues that contributed to a defeat and more drop points after two previous games in which they dropped points, in the last kick of the ball, basically. So that kind of reared its ugly head again, I would say.
Yeah, I completely agree. And if you've been listening to the podcast this year, since before the season started, I've been commenting on the fullback depth, which I never thought was good enough. And they brought in Ben Sweat to address it. I don't think that particularly worked out. But I think that was very much on display this game. Even this week, you know, I was talking about the fact that, you know, the roster freeze was Friday. So there was an opportunity to still bring in a free agent. And to me, that was the area to bring one in, right back in particular at this point. You actually asked Kurt Arnolfo, I believe, in the press conference this week, whether they were going to make any moves before the roster freeze. And he basically said, no, the roster's set. We're not looking to make moves. I think that was a mistake. I think you'd probably agree based on your takeaway that that was a mistake. But the fullback depth in particular is really bad. You're forced to play either Andrew Farrell, who for the last many, many years of his career has been a center back and a pretty solid center back, was a right back earlier in his career, but I think now that he's on the wrong side of 30 is not the time to make the switch back to right back. And then you have Matt Polster, who also played some right back a long, long time ago in his career, playing right back instead of defensive midfield. And he's done okay, I think. I like his performances better than what we saw from Andrew Farrell. But at the same time, I think when you talk about kind of the midfield options, I'd rather see him available in the midfield. I think he's probably still the Rev's best number six, despite the performances that Kay's put in. So you're potentially weakening yourself or limiting your options there when you have him at right back. But I mean, we can talk about center back depth too. I think that will be fixed when Henry Kessler gets back healthy. But full back depth, I don't know that there's much you can do about it at this point. And I think they've kind of hamstrung themselves because Brandon Bye is out for the season, and you don't have a true backup right back. Both of your backup right backs are guys playing out of position, or DeJuan Jones, who can play right back pretty well, and then leaving yourself with a hole at left back.
Yeah, I mean you touched on all those points, and the fact that just fundamentally the lack of depth at those positions then has this knock-on effect where it bleeds out into other parts of your team, where you have to kind of then move one piece over to account for another, but then that piece is out of position. You know, like Farrell moving to right back means that you're pushing Omar Gonzalez back into a starting role, which, while, you know, and we can talk more about this, I am thrilled for Omar that he's kind of had like a little mini renaissance. That's still, in terms of the general results of the game, has not necessarily been a good thing for the team, because Omar, even playing as well as he can, is still, you know, a center back in his 30s who you're putting on an island because they play a high line, especially when last night when they fall behind, and you don't want that. That can lead to bad things. And then also just, you know, DeJuan, I've always felt him playing on the right side is never, he's never been as impressive at all or as, you know, involved in the game as he should be, as he is when he's on the left side. And yeah, it's just, you know, then what you have, as you said, also, I mean, Matt Polster has to come in sometimes to play right back, and then that takes away your best, maybe your best, still your number six, I think. And we can talk about, you know, the midfield as well later on, but I do think that, you know, Polster, just anyone having to play over in that role for Bye. Yeah. It just highlights how it was such a known issue that they could have maybe tried to make one more move to address. And that, yeah, I mean, when I asked Kurt about that, he was very definitive that he said, no, we're done. And I understand maybe in the context immediately of the club with everything else happening that maybe, you know, the efforts to push to make one more signing weren't quite there. But, you know, again, that kind of highlights why all of this was so damaging to the club, is that, you know, moves that maybe should have been made weren't made down at the wire here. And that's directly affecting the team on the field.
Yeah, last night really is the perfect example, because I didn't think, you know, Andrew Farrell has at times filled in admirably. I think he's only done it once before in the season at right back. But this game, I thought he looked pretty poor. I also thought DeJuan Jones didn't really look himself in this game. I thought he had a bad game. You know, the second goal was his man kind of cut around him. The first goal, I don't want to put the blame on him, but I thought he might have been the closest defender to the goal scorer there and didn't really track the runner. It looked like he was potentially tired from all the travel with the national team. And I think, again, if you have better depth, maybe this is a game where you give DeJuan Jones a rest. So, you know, even you know, when your starters are healthy, it's sometimes nice to have depth when you're playing the worst team in the league, where maybe you can give your left back who's just traveled with the national team a little bit of a break. So I think there's a lot there that's kind of come back to bite the Revs, in particular in this game. But there's nothing they can really do at this point other than what the options they have internally, because the roster freeze deadline has now happened. They made no moves to address the fullback issue. So they're stuck with what they're stuck with.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, as you said, you know, DeJuan, who is a player who I, you know, since I've been, you know, covering the team, and really since, I guess, you know, he's come into the team, has been a player who I've enjoyed watching and who I've enjoyed watching develop significantly in his time. But yeah, certainly not his best game. And yeah, that second goal, I'm sure he would want that back. And as you also said, I mean, yeah, I never fully know who to put blame on for a set piece unless it's sometimes very, very obvious. But like in that case, and maybe it was like one of two different guys. I think that, you know, of course, there was never a thought that they could rest him or that they could ever rest, you know, a player like Dave Romney, who played well last night, but was also just scrambling because that was just the nature of the game. You know, he was, again, like I said, put on an island many times just because of how they were trying to approach the game, and especially when it started to go against them in the second half. So, you know, I mean, it also, you know, and we haven't mentioned this yet, but, you know, I don't think Earl Edwards was personally responsible for either of those goals individually, but you do also, there is the sort of implicit thought in the minds of anyone watching this team that, like, would Georgi Petrovic have maybe made that save on the second goal? And it's impossible to know. And that would have been a really tough save either way, but it is a thought in people's minds now. And it's just like one additional part of this where you used to have rock solid, guaranteed, above average, near MLS leading goalkeeper play. And now you don't. And again, like, that's an impossible task for Earl to come in and try to replace that. He's doing the best that he can, but it is just one more thing where it's like, you know, you have one less layer of defense essentially. And yeah, that, you know, I don't know if that played a direct role, but that was another in a series of factors that contributed to a defeat last night.
Yeah, 100%. And I think Earl Edwards, too, you know, he's done an admirable job, but there's been times where he's made some questionable decisions coming out on, you know, set pieces, not necessarily getting the ball every time. And, you know, he hasn't been Georgi Petrovic. Nobody's going to be Georgi Petrovic, yeah. But he certainly hasn't been. He has made some good saves. I don't want to, you know, be too harsh on him. I think he's been a decent keeper, but you've gone from, like you said, the best keeper in the league to a decent keeper. And I think this game and a couple of the past games too, there's been, you know, some goals that have gone in that, you know, you can't blame Edwards too much for, but if you had the best keeper in the league, maybe things go differently. Especially when you're talking about the defense being, you know, not at full par. It's great to have kind of that backstop behind you that can save you a goal or two in a game that you might have otherwise conceded. And, you know, I don't want to get too much into it because you already covered it pretty well. But, you know, the other thing with the fullbacks too is, you know, even if Matt Poulsen is, you know, your right back and is doing a good job, you're not getting the same offensive contribution from him that you do from a Brandon Bae. And I do think this is a team that has over the years relied pretty heavily on the fullbacks for offensive contributions. You talked about, you know, the assist totals of Brandon Bae and DeJuan Jones and their goal contributions. You're not going to get that from Matt Poulsen at right back. And so even if defensively he's solid, it does kind of limit your offense and make your offense a bit more predictable when you don't have that contribution out of your right back too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and I think also you kind of saw it in their buildup play. You saw how they struggled to really build out of the back in a way that they have made a pretty signature, a pretty signature thing in the last couple of years. And you saw that, you know, like, just the progression of the ball. You look at like who led the team in touches and passes, and other than Carles, it's basically, you know, aside from maybe Mark Anthony Kay, it was a lot of guys along your back line. And that's just usually indicative of the fact that, okay, you know, you were able to possess the ball, and they had 61% possession and completed 84% of their passes as a team, which all looks good on paper. But the reality was that, you know, look at their final third passing, and I think it was below Colorado's last night, and that, you know, sort of showcased what was really the problem, which was they could keep the ball, but they couldn't move the ball into dangerous positions. And that is one area where you definitely miss, you know, a player like Brandon Bae getting forward, and a player like DeJuan, maybe when he's a little more locked in, you know, getting forward and helping to create a little bit more, because, you know, especially a player like Vrioni, who I'm sure we're going to get to, looked pretty isolated last night. So whatever problems you might have with him individually, there was a collective issue in getting him the ball, I felt.
And this all sort of leads to what my takeaway is, which is that, you know, I also made the same takeaway I'm about to make now about a month or two ago and had the same question. But now that there's only six games left in the season, it's a bit more concerning. There's six games left this year, and I still have no idea what the best lineup or formation is for this team. I don't think it's what we saw last night, but I don't know what it is. You know, one striker doesn't seem to be working with Rioni. But at the same time, now that you've brought in a guy like Chonkele, you're kind of designing yourself to play with wingers, right? So I don't know, and it's been a kind of a question of mine throughout a lot of Bruce Arena's tenure, is he's built a roster that is almost set up to play two different ways, and it's hard to get your best players in the field in a way that works to their strengths every game. So, you know, you have Carles Hill, who is arguably the best number 10 in the league, unless we're counting Messi as a 10, I will no, but outside of Messi, you have Carles Hill, who is arguably the best number 10 in the league. And when you have a number 10 like him, you want him to be in the center of the field, right? And so if you're playing with two strikers, that really limits what formation you can use to actually have Carles Hill in the center of the field. So you can play a 4-4-2 diamond, which is narrow and usually doesn't involve wingers. You can play a 4-3-3, which again, you're ending up with one, you know, you're listing three fours, but you're really playing with one striker and two wingers, or you can look at that as a 4-5-1, depending on how you want to look at it. Or you could theoretically play a 3-5-2 or 5-3-2, depending on how you want to fit that. But then either you're playing, you know, your wingers as fullbacks, or you're not playing your wingers, right? So, or wingbacks, whatever you want to call it. You could, you know, half a dozen of one, you know, whatever you want to call it. But I don't know what this team's best formation at this point to get everyone on the field, because I don't think Vrioni at one striker is working particularly well, at least not in games like this. Maybe in games where, you know, the game is a bit more open and the other team is attacking more and there's more space, maybe that works when the Revolution can kind of play the ball on the ground and find gaps in the defense. But when they're a compact team like Colorado, it's clearly not working. So I just don't know at this point what the team's best formation is. Now, I know Seth Makehomer said it's probably a 4-4-2, but I don't know what that looks like, right? So let's go back to 2021 when the Revs won the Supporters Shield. They played a very wonky formation that year. It worked, but their starting midfield was Matt Polster as your six, and then they had Tejon Buchanan as sort of your right center mid slash right wing, and because he's kind of a freak athlete that could cover a ton of ground, that worked. And then you had Tommy McNamara on the left side, who is a very, very different player than Tejon Buchanan, and that made your midfield very unbalanced. And you had Carles Hill as your 10. So it worked, and they won the Supporters Shield not just playing that formation, but largely playing that formation. But I think because of that, there's a lot of thought that, you know, maybe they can do that again and have a wide guy and a diamond. I just don't know that they have the personnel to do that anymore. I think that worked because you had Tejon Buchanan, who could do just about everything and cover so much ground. I don't think Chonkley is that guy. I don't think Nacho Hill is that guy. And I just don't know what that looks like, right? So, yeah. I think they have six games left to figure something out, but I still have no idea what that is, right? Because Gustavo Bo's coming back at some point soon, we think, and then it probably makes sense to play two strikers. But then, what do you do with Chonkley? Because I don't think you can play a 4-4-2 wide diamond that has two wingers and not get torn apart in midfield. I just don't think you can. I think maybe you have what you did in 2021 and have kind of a unbalanced one where you have another center mid that's sort of playing on one of the sides and then a winger that maybe you can find lightning in a bottle and do that again. I'm really struggling to figure out how you get all your guys in the field in a formation that fits your best players at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, and listen, as someone who was at the same sort of simultaneously confounded by and fascinated by their formation in 2021, when they had that, as you said, that sort of asymmetrical 4-4-2 diamond, where Tejon, is he a center midfielder? Is he a right winger? Like, he was the only guy who could ever, that I've ever seen at any level, really almost pull off those combinations of two positions into one. And so I think assuming that anyone else can come in and replicate that is a little aggressive, maybe. So I think that, yeah, I mean, I agree. Like, I don't, you know, I mean, the thing about the 21 team also was that, you know, Gustavo is a very interesting player in that he is a forward who also can drop off and help, you know, combinations with the midfield. And you need someone like that. If you're going to play that type of two striker setup, you need someone who can drop in. It does not appear like Vrioni is that kind of player, even though I've seen him have plenty of technical ability. I know he makes smart runs. I mean, even last night, you look at some of the rare chances that they had, and I'm forgetting the exact one, but one of those was directly as a result of Vrioni making a run and drawing defenders. And you see he's capable of that kind of intelligent positional play. And so, you know, I know that he has plenty of critics, especially after a performance like that last night, where he was basically uninvolved for large periods of time. But, you know, I don't use that as a way to dismiss him from being in the team. I think he has plenty of quality. But, yeah, it definitely doesn't seem like he's a lone nine or, you know, a lone striker that you can trust up front. But then, you know, yeah, the problem is, I mean, Nacho Hill has played really well. So what are you going to put him out of the lineup? You know, obviously Chankalai is a player who they have high hopes for, but seems a little inconsistent. Like last night, he completed a lot of his passes, but other than that, didn't do that much and was not super involved in the buildup, really. So, you know, yeah. And then, you know, you bring on a player like Noel Buck and you're like, well, why wasn't he starting? But, you know, at the same time, I think all of this in my mind really just shows in a way how underrated Matt Polster has been for a little while in terms of just wearing so many different hats in the midfield for them, where they have a guy who is ostensibly a number six, but also a guy who tracks forward a lot and is in a more box to box role sometimes. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm just listing guys here, but it's just like they have so many pieces that they could potentially put into a lineup that while it's a good problem, I always felt like with Bruce in his tenure that was kind of a thing he almost cultivated for a lot of the year. It was like, we just need a lot of guys. And then at some point we'll just kind of figure it out. And you want that later in the season. You don't want to play your best soccer. You figure it all out in May and then just sit on that for months. You want to build to something, but I'm not sure it really feels like they're building to something. Obviously larger circumstances in the club playing a role in that. But even if it was all still the same setup and Bruce was still the coach and everything and everyone was still there, I still wasn't necessarily super confident that they had figured it out or were on their way to figuring it out. Because, yeah, I mean, these, you know, performances from Brioni and just the injuries to players like Gustavo just kind of going in and out of the team have fettered their development towards finding a best 11 for sure.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And really, when you looked at how this roster was coming together towards the end of the season and the additions they made, and then even projecting to 2024, it really looked like they were set up to build or to play in a very, and now that, you know, Bruce is gone, I think it's you can't assume anything. Who knows what the next coach is going to want to do next year. But it seemed like they were building a good roster to play, you know, a situation where you had Chankalai, Carles Gil, Dylan Barrero, when he was healthy, as kind of your front three of your midfield. And then that would almost have to be behind a lone striker. And on paper, you'd think that lone striker would be Vrioni, but now it doesn't seem like that would really work because he's, you know, he's not particularly a good hold-up striker. He does do some things really well. I don't want to dismiss him either. I think when he's paired with another striker and in the right situation, we've seen he can score a lot of goals. But it, you know, assuming all those guys are back, it almost seems like that would have made sense. I don't think you can do that with two strikers, because I think if you have, you know, Chankalai, Carles Gil, Dylan Barrero, and then you just stick Matt Polster behind them, you're asking Matt Polster to do way more than one man can do. I think you have to have another central midfielder, whether it's, you know, a K or a Buck or a Harks next to him, and you can't do that with another striker. So I could go on forever about this, but you're right. It's a good problem to have in the sense that, you know, you have a lot of central midfielders that you can't necessarily all get on the field at the same time, and you have some options there. That's a good problem to have, but it's a bad problem in the sense that I don't think they really have any striker that's a good option as a lone striker up top. I don't think, you know, Bobby Wood might be the best option of a bunch of, you know, bad options. And I'm not saying they're bad strikers. I'm just saying as lone strikers, they're not great options. And so that's where I don't know how this plays out, but I think that's a big problem for the Revolution, because they've also tried a 4-4-2, you know, standard diamond earlier this season, where they were playing, you know, Buck and central midfield, you know, two central midfielders with Blessing and Buck and whoever else, and that didn't really work either. So even if you were kind of to throw Chankalai and Nacho Hill out the window and leave them on the bench, and they have a lot of good, you know, in theory, central midfielders, I don't think they really were able to get that to work either. And that works even less well now that Brandon Bae is out, because when you're doing that, you're requiring width from your fullbacks, and you're not going to get that from Polster or Farrell, I think, or at least not enough of it at this point. So I'm kind of at a loss at how this team figures it out going into the playoffs and what that looks like. No matter what they do, good players are going to have to sit. And that, again, that's not necessarily – that part of it's not necessarily a bad thing. But if your best formation is, you know, a 4-3-3 or 4-5-1, and the only thing that's holding you back is you have a striker that doesn't fit it, that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's not like you – I don't think it's – if Bo is healthy, you kind of have to play him too. That's not really a viable thing for – a coach of this current version of the Revs to have a healthy Gustavo Bo and not play him. So obviously, and obviously I don't think that would happen, if you had to pick between him and Vrioni, I think I was, you know, you pick Bo at this point. But yeah, I mean, he's not a guy who likes to play up front by himself either. He's not a, you know, traditional sort of hold up play striker. But yeah, I mean, if you go back to a two striker setup, which I feel they're sort of inevitably trending towards if Bo is healthy again, then yeah, I mean, as you said, I mean, what do you ditch the wingers? I think like you bring in, you know, you have Harks and I mean, theoretically that lineup can come together. Like you could put together a lineup with Vrioni, Bo up top, Carles behind them as the 10, Harks and maybe Noel Buck or Harks and Polster or Harks or Polster and Buck in there as like sort of shuttling midfielders and then Kay as the holding midfielder if you want to run that route and then the defense behind them. But yeah, I mean, as you're saying, like then what that means, Andrew Farrell is your width on the right side if he's playing right back. That's not going to be a thing that really works unless you're trying to completely change your style of play, play a deeper defensive line and try to grind some games out. But that doesn't seem like that's in the cards for this Revs team. So yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I think we're probably trending back towards some try to eat their cake and have a two set up where you have that sort of asymmetrical formation where one of those midfielders is also nominally a winger. And that might be a Nacho Hill or a Chonkalai. But I don't think that's a setup that I have not seen it really used, I guess, even because we haven't seen too much of Bo and Vrioni with Chonkalai or Hill and that sort of setup in the last couple of weeks. But I'm not sure if that's even in its best version, something that's going to work. But, you know, I mean, yeah, that's usually it's good problems. But I think, yeah, again, it all comes back to those injuries on the back line. I think that is having a huge detrimental effect on the team as a whole, because if Bai was healthy, maybe you could run that setup. But without him, you can't.
Yeah, and just one last point, because I know we're going to have to revisit some of this conversation and all the questions we got. But the only other thing I'll add is, too, is that, you know, a few years ago, we did see a situation or a formation where Carles Hill was kind of nominally your right-sided midfielder in the formation, although he had, you know, plenty of freedom to cut inside. And I don't want to see them go back to that. I think you lose a little bit of something when he's not in the center and he's, you know, not quite as involved. But that actually worked when they did that, because Brandon Bai made such good overlapping runs and provided the width, exactly. And the two of them combined really well. So I don't even think that's an option anymore. I don't like that option, even if Brandon Bai is healthy, but there's at least maybe some merit to finding a way to fit everybody on and do that and make him kind of your nominal right wing guy that can cut inside. But I think right now that's not even an option. So the fullback problem limits, I think, what you can do at this point on top of everything else.
Yeah. And, you know, and of course, you know, the door three that you very briefly mentioned when we were talking about formations was, you know, sort of three back system. But of course, that is essentially completely out the window right now, because even if Henry Kessler comes back, then like, what are you going to play Farrell as the right wing back then with Kessler, Omar and Romney as a back line? Like that's, you're not at all close to your best 11 in that case, in my opinion. But that's too bad, because that would, in other circumstances, maybe be the viable solution to all of this, where you switch to that. But that's not even an option right now. So really, yeah, they're looking at a bunch of four-back formations where I am not entirely sure if you're ever going to find the best version of your best 11, because I don't really know what that is. Because I think like there's a whole just tranche of players right now of like your Harkses, Bucks, Chonkalais, Nacho Hills, etc., where you're like, and maybe even Boateng at different points will fit into that, where it's like, are they a starter, are they not a starter consistently? And you know, I mean, even Polster and Kay are in that, because you know, maybe they're competing for the same spot. So the last couple of weeks, I mean, along with everything else happening, and I feel that's a sort of a blanket statement for the Revolution at this point, along with everything else happening at the club, there is also the idea that like, I feel like I'm farther away from knowing who is in the starting lineup and who isn't in like seven different guys' cases.
Yeah, and with six games left, it's not a lot of time to figure it out. Yeah. But we got a lot of questions, and I think several of them will take us back to this conversation. And there's probably more we can add to it with those questions. But before we jump into listener questions, I want to take a minute to talk about the sponsor of this podcast, Galacho Kits. Galacho Kits is the go-to place to bring unique vintage jerseys to your home. The passion for the beautiful game doesn't have borders, and neither does the selection. And if you head to GalachoKits.com today, you can get 15% off your order using the promo code REVSRECAP. That's REVSRECAP at checkout for 15% off your order. All right, we got a lot here. I'll start with one that's more tongue-in-cheek. Sunday afternoon fullbacks on Twitter says, is the "we won the possession battle" tweet that the Revs sent out the single greatest troll job we have seen in any Revs Twitter history?
I mean, you know, in a week of some tough social media moments for the club. Yeah, I mean, it's not their best look. You know, it's just, I don't know. They're trying to put any kind, not even a smile face, but just a face maybe on some of this stuff. And it's just, there are no wins for them in that regard right now.
Adam McLean on Twitter said, I fell asleep after the first goal, then woke up to see the ending. But from what I saw, Chonkley didn't seem involved much. Notice he was already off when Sweat and Tico Rivera came on. Did I miss something with him? Can you talk about his performance?
Talk about Chonkley, you said? Yeah. I mean, I think I mentioned him earlier, and yeah, it's like, you know, to be honest, I hate to agree with the guy who admittedly fell asleep during the game, but you know, it's like, yeah, I guess he didn't really miss a whole lot there. I mean, he completed most of his passes. I think he had over 90%. And so you're like, a main criticism that I guess I would have had with him in previous games in terms of losing the ball more than maybe he should have. You know, he doesn't seem to find the game in the same way that I think Nacho Hill was last night a little bit. That's not all his fault, certainly. I mean, like, there's only so much you can do if the ball is just literally on the other side of the field. But in terms of making a difference in the team, you would want someone like that to be taking chances. He did, I think, have one or two shots, but was largely, yeah, uninvolved.
Yeah, I think from his involvement against Austin, you know, however long ago that was now, that you had high hopes for him and you expected him to be a lot more involved in the offense than he was. So it was kind of a disappointing performance. I don't think he necessarily did anything, you know, egregiously wrong. I just don't think he was as involved as you would have liked to have been. But you're right. He has his consistency with him. We haven't seen it yet. And to some extent, it's understandable. He hasn't been here that long. You know, he's shown some really good flashes like that Austin game. But it takes time to build chemistry and everything to work out. But yeah, it wasn't a great performance from him.
I think, honestly, you know, maybe this is kind of a take, but I don't think he should be starting right now, because I think, like, you know, especially with everything else, again, I'm saying this again, I feel like it should be like a drinking game with everything else happening in the club. Like, you know, I think you shouldn't be looking to a guy like that, who's only been here a little while, to try to like make the difference for you in these kind of important games. I think you should be trying to phase him in a little bit more. And so maybe that, you know, if they were going with that, maybe that would help provide a little clarity in the lineup. But I think they are just kind of, I don't know, throwing stuff at the board right now and seeing what sticks, including, hey, we signed this Argentinian guy who maybe can score some goals, so let's get him in there. And I feel like that just, yeah, it's proving out the way that I thought it would, with just like some games he's involved and looks great. Other games he's not at all, and you really don't necessarily know he's on the field.
Yeah, and Adam McLean on Twitter also asked, how do you feel about the substitution timing and player choice? He says he was surprised to see both Ben Sweat and Tico Rivera, but no Boateng. I was also surprised.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, I think that I'm always a little bit surprised. I think it's just because Esmer looks like super young. So when I see him getting subbed in, I know who he is, obviously. And I've seen him play enough times now that I'm like, yeah, he's a real professional player. He can play at this level. But I'm always just like, wait, what? Who are we bringing in? Just like, what's the decision? But, you know, then, of course, I honestly thought Esmer came on and played pretty well, or as well as someone could, again, in sort of the circumstances. I thought Buck came on and played pretty well. And honestly, you know, Tico Rivera, you know, he came on. I think, like, he was just, you know, maybe he just wasn't fully ready for the moment. There were a couple mistouches there. You know, I'm always like, would Boateng maybe not be a better call in that moment? But, you know, I think also when they were making those subs, was that, I'm trying to remember if that was 1 or 2 nothing down, but,
all the subs came after it was 2-0. I take it back. The Buck and Esmer sub came right after, the minute after the second goal happened. So all the subs were post the second goal.
You know, so by that point, I mean, what, you're already chasing the game pretty hard. And so, you know, those subs are coming on to just try to do something miraculous, which it's a little tough to grade them. But yeah, I mean, just some of the choices. Yeah, I mean, Ben Sweat coming on. I mean, again, like, by that point, you're already down multiple goals. Why are you not throwing on a player who maybe adds a little more offensively? You know, no disrespect to Ben Sweat. You know, he's out there obviously trying his best, but it's just, you know, situationally, maybe not the guy. Yeah, I don't, you know, I mean, I thought, like, they things had already kind of played out a little bit. Like, if you wanted impact subs, maybe you would have done that before it got to 2-0, would be, I guess, my main takeaway from that.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And on top of that, though, I would say, you know, they were, like you said, they were chasing the game. They were down 2-0. All of the subs that they made were on paper like-for-like subs, right? It was a center mid for a center mid, a fullback for a fullback. You know, different players. They're very different characteristics from the players that they brought on. But they didn't really throw everything at the wall in the sense that, you know, they waited. And I know we got another question from somebody about why did it take so long to get Bobby Wood on. So shout out to whoever asked that. probably won't bring it up again. But Bobby Wood, Vrioni was having a difficult time getting into the game. Why did they wait till the 77th minute to bring on Bobby Wood? And when you're down 2-0, maybe you bring on Bobby Wood as a second striker instead of taking out your striker, right? It did seem kind of conservative substitutions in a game where you're down 2-0, and that they, you know, didn't really change up the formation very much. They just, I mean, they pushed more guys forward, to be sure. That's why they kept getting stretched at the end. But the subs were, for the most part, kind of like-for-like subs.
Yeah, and it looked like, you know, to that, like, it kind of looked like for most of the game, Colorado, just in their basic marking, had everything accounted for, you know, like they weren't really bothered by anything that the Revs were doing in terms of movement or in terms of passing. Like every single time that they either pressed or tried to just even contest the ball, it looked like they, you know, there was no sort of, you know, off marking that, you know, they had to worry about or any kind of, you know, anything the Revs were really doing that really put them under serious pressure just in terms of the game plan or the formation. And then, yeah, those subs, you know, as you said, it was like for like, they just, you know, one striker for the next. I think part of the problem is that Bobby Wood is not someone who is going to come on and be super different in sort of, or complement Vrioni. I think when we've seen them play together, it seems like they almost sort of make the same runs and they both kind of play the same way. Bo is the guy who you'd be like, yeah, maybe you bring him on and he could drop a little deeper and provide another element to something that Vrioni's doing. So maybe that was the thought process in terms of why they didn't want them both on at the same time. But again, yeah, I mean, as I said, like, you're down 2-0 in a game that you kind of, well, you don't need to win, but like, obviously it hurts you to do anything other than win in a playoff race. So why not just go for it and just throw them at it? But, you know, I guess Clint Pie in his first game just kind of went with maybe a plan there to try to keep the shape the same. And, you know, what we saw was, yeah, just a lot of possession without a lot of generating of chances.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say here, and if you're following me on Twitter, I was hammering why is Boateng not coming into this game. I get, or at least I could justify Esmir coming on before Boateng. I think Esmir and some of his recent appearances has looked good, and I thought he looked pretty good in this game. So that doesn't bug me that much. Rivera over Boateng, I don't understand that. I not to hammer on Rivera, he's had his moments for the Revs, but Boateng's been a guy that, you know, you bring on in the 70th minute, and he's been lightning in a bottle for the Revs a lot of times over the years when they've been down a goal. He's provided that spark. He's got a ton of pace. You're going against a team in Colorado that's been playing really hard at altitude, tired legs. He's got more pace than Rivera. You know, he's got the experience. He's been consistent as far as his ability to cross the ball into the box. You're throwing numbers for Omar Gonzalez up the field late. I don't understand that. And then, okay, even if Rivera has looked really, really good in practice, and I saw somebody throw out the theory as, you know, Clint Pie was coaching Revs too. He saw a lot of Rivera. He saw a lot of Esmir. You know, maybe he felt more comfort there. But even if we, you know, take all that, give him the benefit of the doubt, what is the point of bringing Ben Sweat on in the 86th minute when you're down 2-0? I don't get, you know, why not throw caution to win, bring on a speedy guy and Boateng? I just don't know what the point of bringing Ben Sweat on is, unless you're, you know, concerned about goal differential. But even that, I don't think Ben Sweat is that good of a defender.
Yeah, that's a sub that honestly felt like, you know, and I don't have anything to obviously verify that, this is just me talking, but that kind of just felt like a sub of, you know, we've been in charge of the team for a couple of days. We have a preset plan of subs maybe that we'll run through. And this is maybe one of them. Because yeah, I can't really work out a reason for it maybe other than that, because exactly. As you said, I mean, who cares at that point? Like, you know, your defensive solidity has already been pierced twice and you're down 2-0. Who cares about, like, you know, preventing a third goal at that point? You want to try to impact the game going forward. And Ben Sweat, you know, much as he might try valiantly for that, is not going to do it in the same way that Boateng would.
All right, we will switch to some positive questions. The one player that came out of this game.
There are any?
Well, actually more positive comments than questions, but the one player that came out of that game, looking somewhat good, Omar Gonzalez. Chad Crush on Twitter says, Omar is back and I'm here for it. Steve McGrogan on Twitter says, heroes aren't born, they are cornered. And Carly's heel cornered Omar tonight, so at least there's that. Eddie Heppner on Twitter said, Omar's redemption arc, love that. Also, really wish we utilized the late Omar run more. It feels like most of the time he and Romney just chill central. Obviously, Omar's run on set pieces was effective in this one when he got the chance. I don't know if there's anything to add to any of that, but yeah, it was a good night for Omar Gonzalez, and I'll go out and say I thought Omar was done after last year, and his redemption arc this season and his ability to be a useful player and, you know, look pretty good doing so was not something I expected this year. So if we want to take one positive from the game, I think that's a fair one.
So I actually had sort of two positives. The first one, I guess, would be Omar in that I think beyond also any of his contributions directly on the field or in the game or just, I guess, playing in the game is that he's just, you know, he's a natural leader around the team. And especially at a time like this, like you want to have guys like that and you want to have guys like that on the field and trying to lead. And he was doing all that, you know, like you could see his demeanor was at the start of the second half, it looked like, you know, he was kind of smiling and they were trying to get guys excited. And, you know, those are all things that, you know, that's why Omar was brought in here probably, you know, to provide a veteran leadership. And he's doing that. And then obviously, you know, leading by example, scoring a late goal last night, where if they, you know, maybe things gone a little bit different and they'd only conceded once, that would have been a much more dramatic goal because it would have been an equalizer and that would have been a better moment for him. I felt that even when they put him on an island last night, which they did quite a bit, especially in the second half, he actually, you know, held together as well as he could. It's just that, look, he's just not, he's not the right type of player for that system, just fundamentally, because he's not that fast at this point in his career. I don't think he was ever really that fast at any point in his career, but especially now it's, you know, one or two steps slower, but, you know, he's doing the best that he can, but he's just not the right guy for that system. So it is a little worrying every single time that they have to start a player like him, because just the way that they inherently play with a higher line, like that's a player who is always going to be, it's going to be a little bit of a gamble running with someone like that. But yeah, I mean, as far as his overall sort of mini renaissance, you could call it in the last, you know, this season, really, I've enjoyed that, because anytime you spend time around Omar or, you know, having gotten to talk to him a little bit, you know, he seems like a guy who is very positive, very upbeat, someone who's very good presence in the team, and someone who, especially right now, you do want to be, you know, involved with the squad. So happy for that. I will say the other sort of positive takeaway was just a more general sense, or the last more of a trend, I guess, is Nacho Hill continues to be pretty impressive to me in isolated moments. He didn't have a great game last night, but then again, no one really did. So I'd say that, you know, just his ability to keep the ball and his ability, obviously, to work with Carlos and to just keep things moving and to come back into midfield and try to connect play between midfield and attack is something that they need more of. And so I hope that whether he continues in a starting role or is like a super sub or whatever, that, you know, they keep him around for a little bit, because, you know, he was injured for a long time, but now that he's in the team, I must say, you know, I didn't necessarily see this coming from him, but I've been a little bit impressed with him.
Yeah, all very good points. And just back to Omar quickly, you can never question the off the field stuff from him. Even last year when things were going really poorly on the field for him, you know, you heard nothing but good things from the young players in the team about his mentoring, about the, you know, his leadership skills. So it's nice to see that, you know, a guy that's doing the right things off the field is now doing some of the right things on the field as well. It's a good feel-good story during not a very feel-good time for the Revs. And on a not-so-feel-good story, we're going back to Giacomo Vrioni, who we've got lots of not-so-positive questions and comments about, I guess unsurprisingly. Matt Clayman on Twitter says, do you think Vrioni has played his best yet, or is there something still to unlock in him? He's had a few good games, but a lot of times he's just floating out there with little participation in the action as a lone striker. OT Daddy on Thread says, why is Vrioni as useless as a speed bump on a runway? We have a lot more specific Vrioni questions, but I guess we'll take a break here and then jump to those. But do you think Vrioni has played his best yet, or is there still something left that the Revs have not unlocked?
Oh, yeah, there's absolutely so much more to his game, I think. Now, I don't necessarily agree with the idea that it's just on the Revs to unlock that. I think, obviously, you know, there's a lot internally with any player in unlocking their own best self. And I think for whatever reason, Vrioni himself has not maybe reached that stage. But yeah, I do think that there's a level that he can be at that just collectively the Revs have not maybe put him in position to unlock. So yeah, I think it's a bit of both. But I definitely... I think there's another level to his game for sure.
Yeah, and then we have some of the potential excuses for him. Eddie Heppner on Twitter says, I think our system is really isolating our striker too much. You mentioned that in the last game in particular, last night. He said, Vrioni makes good enough runs, but it seems like they can always just throw two on him and keep numbers back. And then Teal Forever says, why can't Vrioni perform at a one-striker system? Why are we still trying it?
I mean, that's a fair question. I think that, you know, if there has been anything that we've seen is that this season is that there's probably been enough evidence for whatever else to conclude that that's not his best role. But you know, he's also sort of been like the Revs as a whole been, you know, beset by all these injury problems. Obviously, Bo being out of the team for weeks at a time is never a good thing for the Revs or Vrioni, however you want to break it. And yeah, I think, you know, it seems like his natural inclination is to make these, like, you know, sort of long arc, wide sweeping runs a lot of the time. And that's a very good, you know, notion for a forward, but it also has to sort of fit into the more tactical, the lower level tactical, you know, sort of habits of the team. And with Carles, I mean, like, we've seen Carles ping really great balls in for Vrioni at different points in previous games this season. And that system does work every once in a while, but it's still a pretty low percentage play, and that sort of felt like their best route to attack for part of last night's game, which is not good. So I would like to see more from him trying to check two and maybe, you know, play the ball to feet more. But I'm not really sure what he's being told or what their sort of established game plan is, but it does seem like he has a natural tendency to try to, you know, go for the sort of over the top home run shot or want that played to him. But that's just simply, you know, he has to realize like that ball's not on most of the time, even with a player like Carles.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And as far as the last question is why they're still trying it, I think it goes back to my takeaway is that they, you know, they have a rest of a team that probably fits that formation and a striker that doesn't. So I think they're trying to force it to find a way for it to work. And at some point, you got to try something else. And I think you're getting to that point. Yeah. Josh Glay on Twitter says, to be clear, I'm not a Vrioni hater, but did he do anything good at all this game? And if not, why do we keep playing him? Is it just because Bobby Wood is still recovering? I think you saw a couple positives from him last game, right? Did he do anything good?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's not helping his cause that I can't remember the specific moment. And I think it may have been a Nacho Hill chance on goal, but you know, it was purely as a result of Vrioni making a run near post. And then, you know, the ball allowing, you know, the ball moving, I think back post, that might've been a Nacho shot to the back post. Sorry, there's a train going by my apartment. but yeah, I think, you know, that he did like isolate little moments like that, but largely, yeah, it was not a good day for him. And also just, I mean, you see that in terms of, you know, his sheer or lack thereof of involvement. I think, like, you know, No Buck came on, Esmir came on, a bunch of other players, you know, they all had more touches in the game than Giacomo did. Granted, they're playing different positions, but he just, you know, for whether that's necessarily all his fault or whether that's, you know, a problem of the Revs in terms of how they move the ball, they're just not getting him the ball. And the fact that your striker's not involved in the game is obviously probably a sign that you lost that game.
Yeah, and do you think it has anything to do with Bobby Wood still recovering from injury, or do you think he's back by now and it's purely a, you know, preference choice to get Vrioni out there? And a quick shout out, it was Roberta Voder who asked earlier about why they took so long to get Bobby Wood in. So thanks for that question that we already answered.
Yeah, I think I haven't heard anything specifically about Wood's injury status. I assume that he is healthy. I don't think we've seen anything that he is not in the last at least week or so, but again, it's been a unusual week again. So, you know, it's like, maybe I missed that. I don't believe so, but yeah, I think at this point it's purely tactical. And, you know, Giacomo Vrioni is a designated player. Like, he should in theory be starting absolutely over, you know, Bobby Wood, as much as I've enjoyed Bobby Wood's redemption arc this season. You know, I think like nominally you want your designated players to be starting. So I understand that that's probably a tactical move, and that in its best version, it works because Vrioni has the talent and the ability to be that kind of player. But just, yeah, they just haven't been able to get him the ball and really unlock him, I guess, was the term we were using in terms of him playing his best ball.
And it's only been three games since he last scored a goal, and it was the game winner in the last game they won. So it's not like it's been a rough few games, but it's not like he's been, you know, completely useless to the team this season. He had that hat trick in League's Cup. He's had his moments. I think Greg Johnston, pointed out that he still hasn't scored a goal on the road, which is a bit troubling. But, you know, maybe
also just indicative of the fact that he just still hasn't played like that many games, I want to say. I could be a little bit wrong on that at this point, but it continues to sort of feel like that anyway, with the Revs, where it's like, you know, they just haven't had consistency with those guys up front, you know, with Bo being out for long periods of time as well. So it's just, it doesn't feel like we've seen enough of him or seen enough of him playing alongside some of the guys that you would want him playing alongside.
Yeah. Jose Franchino Dino on Twitter says, why are the Revs addicted to playing a 4-3-3? For the past 3 years, they've been most successful when they play two strikers up top. If Clint is just going to run back with the Richie Williams youth soccer 4-3-3, we can call the season over. I think we've covered this pretty thoroughly. I don't know if you have anything else to add.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we covered that in the entire section where we really talked about how we don't know what their best 11 is. And I think that probably extends to the Revs coaching staff at this point in their heart of hearts, although that's obviously changed over multiple times in the last week. So yeah, I think, yeah, they're still playing 4-3-3 because, as we said, like, you know, your sort of recent strategy has mirrored that with using Chonkalai and Nacho Hill more, but, and currently I guess the roster, you know, you'd want to have at least one striker maybe still on the bench, but yeah, I do question a little bit. I mean, especially with the inability to create consistent chances in the last few games, for sure.
Yeah. Alden on Twitter says, why is Noel Buck not starting? Mark Anthony Kay and Ian Harkes better? Can we not fit Noel, Kay, Harkes, and Carlace into central spots?
Well, I mean, if we did that, then that would necessitate, you know, a change in formation. So then you're telling Chonkalai and Nacho Hill that, like, okay, we're changing the makeup of our team, essentially, unless you wanted to play one of those guys sort of in a, I don't know, sort of like a two, like alongside Hill in an attacking midfield role with still only one lone striker. But yeah, that's really getting into very interesting football manager territory level of like creative formation. And I don't think they're going to do that. But I mean, yeah, I will also ask, like, you know, do we necessarily think Mark Anthony Kay is better than Polster in that role? Do we think Harkes is necessarily better than Buck in that role? I think like they've answered those questions, in affirmatively at times, but I haven't seen it enough to like definitively conclude that. So yeah, there are plenty of guys with a shout for a starting job, but just haven't, other than a couple very notable, you know, exceptions like Carles, really answered that consistently, in my opinion.
And I think Noel Buck and Matt Polster, when they had a run together as kind of your two central midfielders at your 6 and 8, played really, really well and complemented each other really well and built some good chemistry pretty quickly, where, you know, one of them would go forward, the other one would stay back, and they were kind of on the same page and played really well together. And we haven't really had a chance to see that much lately. But I'm not at all convinced that, you know, Kay and Harkes are a better option there than Polster and Buck. I just don't know that we're going to get much opportunity to see that now because of the right back situation, which is, I think, really unfortunate. But I think it's quite possible that your best option, is Polster and Buck instead of Kay and Harkes. And I don't want to, not to say that I think Ian Harkes has been a great player for the Revolution. So it's not a negative on him. Maybe this last game wasn't his best, but I think overall he's been a great player for the Revolution. I think Kay has, done better than I expected for the Revolution. I didn't have too high hopes for him, but I thought he's been a solid player for the Revolution. And this is an area where it's nice that they have, in theory, have some depth and can rotate when Matt Polster's not playing right back. But I'm not at all convinced that Ian Harkes and Mark Anthony Kay should be starting over Polster and Noel Buck, because I think Polster and Noel Buck played really well together and found ways to, contribute offensively, defensively, and make the right runs while the other one stayed back. And, I would like to see that get an opportunity again. I just don't know that we're going to see that, because it's probably Matt Polster is your best right back option on the team right now. And that to me is really unfortunate. But, back to the original question is, if you're going to try to fit all those guys into the field in central spots, you're playing a 4-4-2 standard narrow diamond. And then, like you said, you just brought in Chonkley for you know, a decent amount of money and potential to bring him back as a DP or not a DP, depending on who you believe next year. And you probably want to see what he can do. And it I don't know. It all goes back to our original takeaway, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you brought up a very good point with, you know, what we saw from Polster and Buck. And I agree. Like when they were together, you know, you saw Buck sort of mirroring what Tommy McNamara did in a way, in a very different way, because they're very different players. But just in 2021, when you had that asymmetrical formation, what you were asking of those two midfielders was essentially to play as holding midfielders, but also play as occasionally box-to-box central midfielders. And it's very, very difficult to understand the timing of that and how to walk that line. And like I said earlier, you know, I mean, Polster just wears so many hats for the team, and he's constantly an unsung hero, because as much as I've enjoyed Mark Anthony Kay's ability as a holding midfielder, I think he had the second most touches of anyone in the team last night other than Carles. You saw him completing a lot of passes, and you saw him just, you know, pretty consistently popping up in the right place at the right time to recover possession, which is exactly what you want from a holding midfielder. He doesn't necessarily have the same ability to go forward as Polster does. And I think especially working with a player like Carles, you always want players like that who can maybe trade off and go forward and catch the defense off guard, because Carles is going to find guys like that when they make runs. And, you know, you lose a little bit of that unpredictability, which can be a good thing in an attacking sense, when it's Kay in there instead of Polster.
Yeah, completely agree. On the Revs style tactical conversation, Eddie Hepner on Twitter says, if you had to point out a Revs style of play for the last 5 years, could you? It feels like we have the same structure and tactical weaknesses as the Bruce days, but his great man management is now gone.
Well, I mean, I think what so the question is, if you could point out what their sort of basic philosophy tactically has been the last 5 years, I think it would be, you want to, you know, you have attacking fullbacks, you play with a traditional number 10, and then everything else is kind of just vibes, baby. And that was kind of Bruce ball. And then it was just, you know, winning a lot of one goal games, in which you might not necessarily have the advantage in XG at the end of it, but which you found a way to win because you spent all your money on designated players who can score goals. And yeah, I mean, as we were talking about, that didn't even always necessarily make sense in terms of just building the framework of a team when you had, you know, you've always had two designated player forwards or strikers and then Carles. And so ostensibly you're playing with a sort of, you know, that sort of frontline trio, but like, how are you going to fit all those guys in the team? And yeah, I mean, even now, like, we don't necessarily know how the best way to do that is, even with the latest iteration of that with the Vrioni and Bo and Carles instead of what it was earlier with Buxa and Bo and Carles. And so, yeah, I mean, Bruce Ball was, yeah, it was just like, sign attacking quality, have attacking fullbacks, and then just kind of figure it out in the midfield a little bit and have a really good goalie, I guess, you know, which was fortuitous. So, you know, without, you know, I think as we were saying, like part of it is you don't have Bruce anymore with man management, but part of it is also just other factors. Like you don't have the best goalie in MLS now for the first time in however many years. And, you know, you're one of your outside backs is now hurt for the rest of the season. So they're, you know, sort of hampering factors there that go beyond just a coaching change as well, I guess would be my point. But the style of it is just, it's very attacking and it's very reliant on a number 10 would be the most distilled version, I think.
Yeah. You summed it up much better than I could. So I appreciate that.
it's hard. Cause it's not like, I mean, yeah, it was just a lot of details TBD in there for a long time with Bruce.
Roberto Voter on Twitter says, is it just me or is DeJuan Jones seems to be slower than previously? Is he playing hurt?
I mean, I haven't seen or heard anything to that effect. I think it's maybe just also fatigue over a period of time. I mean, he's worked his way into the national team setup and, you know, he was playing for them and that's outstanding for him. I think even a couple of years ago, I would not have thought that would have been a thing for him. And so I think everyone's thrilled for him to have that, but I think it also comes with, obviously, an increased demands on your conditioning and whatnot and your, you know, ability to play multiple games and to travel and to do all those things that people just take for granted if you're a fan. But that's really hard in real life to just do that and to just show up and then just turn it back on for your club team. And sometimes you see, you know, issues with that. I don't think it's something that I worry about with DeJuan really at all, though. I'd expect, you know, by next game, he'll be back to playing well. I think it's also just, you know, he's working in circumstances that are a little less familiar in terms of, like, you know, they've had a lot of turnover in terms of players and whatnot. I mean, he developed a very good rapport with Ima Boateng, but Boateng hasn't really been in the team as much recently. And so I don't think he's maybe formed up the same partnership yet with Chankalai, but that's neither of their fault. They just haven't played enough together. So I think I'm not worried about Tuan. I think it was just kind of a tough night for him.
Yeah. And I mean, he had a difficult week too. And on top of all the drama with the Revs, he was called up to the national team, what, on like Monday for a game on Tuesday in Minnesota. So I don't know, maybe he flew out Sunday and we just didn't hear about someone. That's probably likely. But anyways, he was called up last minute, flew out to Minnesota, played in that game, not as a sub, not as a starter, but then came out, you know, had to fly. I don't know if he flew back to Foxborough and then flew to Colorado or what they did, but either way, that's a lot on somebody. And I thought he looked fatigued in this game. I don't think he looked 100%. But I'm not worried about it long term. But I, you know, his first touch wasn't as good in this game as sometimes we've seen it, and you know, maybe he couldn't catch up to some of the balls he usually could. But I think it's just a fatigue thing more than anything else, like you said, and I think it'll work its way out. But it, you know, going back to my earlier point, if they had more fullback depth, this is a game that maybe you rest Jermaine Jones in and give him a little bit of a break. But they just don't have that. Yeah, Josh Nye on Twitter says, with 6 games left this season and 13 points separating the Revs from 9th place DC, how far could you see the Revs squad slip, and where are we at on the panic button?
I feel like I am always, doesn't matter the year or the circumstance, I feel like I'm always last to the panic button, just based on my reaction to what I see on social media. I'm always just kind of like, you know, I think they'll... And I guess, you know, I guess that sets up my answer for this, which is I'm not panicking yet. I think emphasis on yet. I think there is a possibility for this to go very south because they're, you know, look, just with everything that's happened within the club, it's a pretty impossible task to ask these guys to come out and just play seamlessly like nothing else has happened and like nothing else is going on. That's, you know, they're human beings. That's impossible to do. So I'm not super surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a little more of a slip. And honestly, just given the proximity of so many other teams to them in the standings, it's not asking for like a monumental collapse for them to fall a bunch of places in the standings anyway. I just think that, yeah, there's a possibility for a bigger slide because, you know, you look at their schedule, you know, like Charlotte and Columbus and, you know, Chicago coming up. None of those games, I mean, all the way through the end of the year with Philly, none of those games are guaranteed wins. And as we saw last night, I mean, in MLS, I mean, as infuriating or maddening as it can be sometimes in this chaotic league, no game is really a guaranteed win. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's all kind of on the line for them. But, of course, having said that, if results had gone differently and they won last night, I mean, I forget the exact set of circumstances, but they could have clinched a playoff spot. So it is kind of a microcosm for MLS in that, like, you know, you're always one game away from maybe clinching a playoff spot, or you're one game away from a club crisis or whatever. So, yeah, I don't I think they'll stabilize and be okay. I think the fact that, you know, with all their injury problems, Carles is not among those people. As long as that is the case, I would give them a chance to maybe even win MLS Cup. But I think at this point, I think it's realistic to just say, like, they're probably heading for, like, you know, a mid seed. Maybe they can hang on to, you know, one of the higher seeds, I guess. But I definitely don't see them ending as the second seed or obviously progressing and catching Cincinnati. I don't think anyone will. But yeah, I think I'm not pressing the panic button. This is a very long-winded answer to that question to say I'm not panicking. But I do think, yeah, there's a possibility they could tumble a little bit, though, for sure.
Yeah, if I was to put a number on it, you know, looking at standings right now, they're only 3 points above Atlanta. Revs are in third now, but they're only 3 points above Atlanta in sixth. So They're 8 points above Nashville in seventh. I would be surprised if they fell to seventh. I would not be surprised if they fell to sixth. So if I was to put a number on how far they might fall, I'd say sixth is how far they might fall. If they fall more than six, things have gone really bad.
Yeah. And I mean, that scenario is out there. You know, I mean, like, they're on to their third coach this season. Clint, you know, could be a good coach at an MLS level. We don't know that yet. And he's being put into an extremely difficult situation here, sort of just totally unprompted. So, you know, there's plenty of scenarios where, I don't know, they do fall into a crisis. But yeah, if I had to agree, I'd say six is probably as far as it goes.
Yeah. Tail Forever on Twitter says, I think the Revs have looked better in set pieces, especially corners right now. Am I grasping for hope in a void of doom?
Well, they did give up a goal on a corner last night, so that's not all good.
I'm going to take this to mean offensive set pieces, because I don't think they've looked good. I would go right out there and say I do not think they've looked good defensively on set pieces.
Right, and so that's, you know, I sort of always include those one and the other in terms of set piece, you know, how you're attacking and also defending set pieces, because in, you know, they're similar sort of setup. But yeah, I mean, yeah, they've definitely looked better attacking. I think that, you know, so not just on corner kicks, but also, yeah, set pieces. I mean, Mark Anthony Kay hit the crossbar in the first half on a Carlos free kick.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I mean, certainly, I mean, that's another reason why you want someone like Kay in the lineup, is he's a bigger guy or taller guy, and he can definitely get to a set piece. And then anytime you have Omar in the lineup, I mean, you need to try to take advantage of that, because that is his absolute best attribute still, as it's always been. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, that's a thing that if you're looking for silver linings, you know, yeah, they have looked a little better, a little more threatening, at least attacking on set pieces.
Yeah, and it seems like they found a better way to utilize Omar on set pieces in this game, too. OT Daddy on Thread says, why does Carles Heel take every free kick in corner instead of ever setting up at the top of the 18?
Well, I mean, you know, I think you want your best. I think it's just a simple thing. Like, who is going to be better than Carlos at delivering the most important part of that sequence, which is the, you know, the initial, you know, cross into the box. I think you want your most skilled, your best player on that. And Carlos is that. So I think, you know, honestly, don't overthink that.
I also don't think Carlos is finishing from the run of play, you know, is that amazing. You know, I don't think if you set him up at the, you know, 20 yards out from goal and give him a pass, that we've seen him do something amazing from there. But I think, you know, to take away your best set piece taker, to put him in that spot thinking that he's going to get a dangerous shot off, I think that's one aspect of his game that from the run of play, I don't think his finishing is necessarily, you know, consistently that good, especially from distance. So I get the comment, but I think maybe you're kind of looking at some of his recent good shots and career wise, I just don't think that's necessarily where he's at his best. So, yeah, but the one thing I will say is I haven't always loved Carles Heel's corner kicks. They were good, I think, in this game, but there's been times where I think Gustavo Bo has taken better corner kicks from him. And if Gustavo Bo was out there, I could see maybe every once in a while switching things up. But with Gustavo Bo, I don't even know who would take your corners with
Carles. And also with Bo, I mean, you're looking for a guy at the top of the box.
That's
We've seen Carlos, you know, that was Bo's first ever goal for the Revs, was a goal directly off a set piece where he just lobbed it up to the top of the box and Bo hammered it in. And so, I mean, he's the guy that you would want in that position. But yeah, I mean, I agree. Carlos is, you know, is set piece delivery has not always been on point. But you know, last night I felt like that was actually one of the better things they were doing.
This, going back to something that we sort of touched on earlier, Till Forever says, are some of these goals allowed just what it is like to have a normal goalkeeper?
I mean, apparently, yeah. I mean, you know, that was a beautiful finish last night on that second goal, I believe from Cabral and from Harris, Calvin Harris. You know, it was just perfectly curled in there. I don't necessarily know if Jorge Petrovic saves that goal. You know, I mean, that was perfectly finished. I think the first one, you know, I mean, we've seen them give up plenty of goals on set pieces with Matt Turner, with Jorge Petrovic. So I don't really blame goalkeeping for the result last night. But, you know, I do think, like, just going a couple games now without seeing some just outrageous save from your goalkeeper does remind you, yeah, okay, you no longer have, you know, that guy in net.
Also, Alfred on Twitter says, I know Kevin Hitchcock, the goalkeeper coach, is a god, but what do you think about Turner and Petrovic playing under former goalkeepers Brad Friedel and Bruce Arena, though? Will we miss this with Vasilik? Despite Kevin Hitchcock still being there.
I don't think that plays a role. I mean, honestly, I know Bruce was a former goalie, but I don't think like that had any effect on why Jorge Petrovic became the guy that he was, or already sort of in a lot of ways was the guy that he was. And definitely with Turner, I mean, you know, I think, you know, I think, yeah, I mean, Friedel, I give him props always for, you know, having the foresight to start Matt Turner initially and give him a chance. But I think Hitchcock is your guy who gets a majority of the credit for both of that, both in terms of identifying talent and then developing it.
Yeah, I'm sure Brad Friedel had some influence on Matt Turner as a goalkeeper that played at the highest level, was a, you know, stalwart for the national team. That I'll I will say I'm sure Brad Friedel had, you know, helped him a little bit. Bruce Arena, you know, he was a goalkeeper, not anywhere near the level of goalkeeper that, you know, Matt Turner, Brad Friedel, Georgi Petrovic was. He got one cap for the United States in the 70s, which was a very, very different time for U.S. soccer. I, not to take anything away from Bruce Arena, but I don't think his experience as a pro goalkeeper in a very different era when the quality was very different, it really had any impact on Georgi Petrovic. I think that was all Kevin Hitchcock. And then on top of all that, you know, Vasilik is he's 34. He's an experienced pro. He's been a starting goalkeeper in La Liga. I don't know that there's that much to change about his game. I'm sure Kevin Hitchcock will find some things to change. But the combination of, I don't think Bruce Arena was that impactful on Petrovic as a goalkeeper and his ability to kind of change his game. And I don't think Vasilik needs that much compared to guys like Turner, who was, you know, very raw when he came to the Revolution, and Petrovic, who was less raw than Turner, but, you know, still a young guy that had areas to improve. So I like this different angle that I hadn't really thought about, but I don't put too much stock in it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, the one thing that we might see with a veteran goalie coming in, as opposed to, you know, the previous versions who were younger goalies, is that you lose a little bit of that, maybe that athleticism, making some of those saves, and the Revs have really benefited from that. So we'll see. But again, it's an impossible mantle for the next goalie, whoever it is, whether it's Earl Edwards or anyone else, to come in and to fully carry, because you're just, again, you're talking about guys who are just basically the best in the league.
Yeah. Golden Hand on Twitter said, should Ezmir get more playing time than Nacho Heal?
I mean, it's just based on what I've seen from like last night, it's tough to say, just because I thought Nacho actually has looked pretty good at different moments. I think like if you're banking on either of those players to really be serious impact players at this point in the season, that's maybe a problem. But I also think that like Ezmir, I made a joke earlier about like how he looks young when he comes on, but like, you know, that he's a perfectly functioning professional player though. I mean, he does not look out of place out there at all. He completes a lot of passes. I like his game in terms of how he kind of gets into those little half spaces and tries to, you know, just keep the ball moving. I think they need more of that sometimes, especially with players around Carles. But I also think that a player like Nacho provides a little more going forward than Ezmir at this point, in terms of ability to take the ball by a guy, in terms of ability to retain the ball, even when he's being absolutely pressed like he was at different points last night. So, yeah, I think I would prefer Nacho for the moment. But, I mean, Ezmir as a guy to come in and play some minutes as a sub, I think, you know, that's a good role for him right now. Maybe you get a little more experience and continue to develop his game. But just in terms of what his game is right now, I do like that.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think Ezmir at the beginning of the season did look a little bit out of place. And I think he's come a long way this year, mm-hmm. which has been, you know, very exciting to see for a young guy like him. So I agree with you. I think that for the time being, I'm still probably on starting Nacho if this is the formation they're going to play. But I think long term, I'd like to see Ezmir getting more minutes. I'm glad to see him coming off the bench. I think maybe come 2024, you start the season off with him as a starter. Well, I mean, that's going to be complicated too if Chonkle is back and Barrero is healthy. If there's opportunities to give him more starting minutes, I think that's more of a next year thing. But any time you can get him off the bench now, I'm all in favor of. John Pilkington on Twitter says, will Damian Rivera be the star player of Rhode Island FC next year?
I mean, I have no idea. I mean, obviously he's currently a Revs player. And I forget exactly what his contract situation is off the top of my head, but I mean, look, you know, that's going to be a new team, and that maybe seems more like the type of level where, Rivera would maybe thrive a little bit, as opposed to with the Revs where he's been, you know, at best a bench player. So yeah, hey, maybe that's in the cards, and that would be really cool for him, you know, given the local ties there. So yeah, I guess TBD, but you know, that would be a fun get for them as a team if they could maybe make that happen.
And John Pilkington is a little less high on Ezmir. He says, will Ezmir ever pass the ball before running directly into opposing players?
I mean, many times. I don't know. Like, he had a pretty good pass completion percentage. I think, like, you know what? He came into a game where they're down 2-0. He's inevitably, I don't know if he's been explicitly told this or not, but he understands, like, look, we got to try stuff in order to try to get back into this game. So, yeah, I'm sure, you know, yeah, his dribbling is not always on par yet. I feel like he still is adjusting to kind of the relentlessness of a, you know, professional high-level game in which, you know, defenders are just moving a little bit faster than they are at some of the other levels maybe that he's been at. But in terms of his passing, I mean, like I said, you know, he came on and in a short period of time had almost as many touches as Tomas Csonkalai in, you know, coming on for the final 30 minutes, and Csonkalai went out after an hour, and he completed 80-something% of his passes, had a key pass, you know, I mean, had a shot. He was trying. And I think, like, you know, as a young player goes, like you said, earlier in the year, I don't think he would have been able to do even that. So I like that development and that growth from him.
OT Daddy on Thread says, when can we expect any real changes from our third manager in the last month and a half? Because we should note that they only made one change to the lineup last night, and that was bringing on Farrell for Polster, which was forced because Polster had yellow card accumulation suspension.
Right. So, yeah, the one differentiation was they were forced to make. I mean, honestly, I think, God, you know, I can't imagine what the week has been like for Clint in that sense. You know, I mean, he came in just sort of out of nowhere, and now suddenly you're managing the first team. And, okay, also, yeah, you have a game in Colorado on Saturday, and so you got to be ready for that. So I'm sure that, you know, it was just boilerplate stuff initially in terms of just like, all right, let's not worry about making any changes. Let's just worry about getting ourselves, you know, just mentally ready for this game after this week we've had. And so, okay, here's the lineup, so everyone knows it. I'm sure that honestly maybe helped them in the short term. I know the result didn't go their way, but, you know, I'm sure in that period of time, it probably was nice to have a guy come in and just sort of represent some level of continuity for the players. But yeah, I think going forward, he's definitely going to want to make changes, because certainly it didn't go well, and that didn't seem like your best 11. So I would expect next game, you know, given a full week in charge now, at least, that he maybe has more of an idea of some of the things that he wants to do. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I think you said it quite well, and I would be surprised if we didn't see some changes next week. Then I would start to be a little bit concerned about the lack of movement. A couple of I guess we're sort of getting into the other topics we haven't talked about. We don't have much time left. But after a very difficult week, Traeger Girardi says, would you qualify that as a united professional performance by the Revs, like they were saying we were going to get from them? John Pilkington also said, did this team seem unified to you?
I mean, it's tough to, I mean, yes, honestly, they, you know, just from the basic signs, like you didn't see guys, you know, arguing and fighting on the field, or you didn't see, you know, open levels of division. So I guess, you know, from a sense, and like I said, you know, at the beginning of the second half, it looked like they were kind of trying to keep their spirits up. Omar was in there trying to get guys joking. And, you know, it seemed like there's enough veteran leadership on the team that I do believe them when they say that they are at least, you know, mostly anyway, or at least by outward appearances, a united front. You know, you'll never fully know, or at least we won't know for now, exactly what's going on in the locker room, especially, you know, after a game like last night, who knows. But yeah, right now it looks like they're united. It looks like all their problems are just sort of regular level. We have injuries in the wrong places to guys, and we don't know who our best 11 is. Like, those are all soccer problems. It doesn't look like their problems are internal player versus player issues to me.
Yeah, I agree. It wasn't a great performance, but it wasn't a collapse where the team went out there and had no motivation and, you know, didn't look like they wanted to play together. So, you know, it's hard to say after a game like that where you've lost to the worst team in the league, but I, you know, I don't think this was a case of these guys are all, you know, disunited and, you know, don't want any part of each other. The one thing I will say, the only kind of, I'm sure there was more than this, but the only one that stood out to me in the broadcast of kind of clash between players in this one, and I should have mentioned it earlier, but it goes back to kind of your point about DeJuan Jones having some chemistry with Ima Boateng. I did see Csonkalai get frustrated with DeJuan Jones at least one point in this game, and had a kind of a lengthy conversation with him where it looked like he was pointing at where he wanted him to go and where he wanted him to pass him the ball. So I thought that was one thing that stood out to me that we haven't mentioned yet, but I also don't think that has anything to do with what's been going on in the past few weeks. I think that's might have had something to do with DeJuan Jones being away with the national team and not getting the chance to get on the same page, but unrelated to kind of the turmoil in the coaching staff in front office.
I think honestly, you know, I'm curious about a player like Csonkalai and how he gels with the team in general, but that would have been true with old coaching staff, mid-level coaching staff, or new coaching staff. I think either one of those scenarios, you would have probably encountered that issue.
Yeah. Ryan Duplicia on Twitter says, the entire fiasco has been ridiculous. I want to stand with the players and trust in them. It has to have been hard in a team that has had so much to deal with internally. I hope they can turn it around. More of a comment than a question, but I think I would agree with that. I'm sure it's been a very tough time for them. And I think, at least from outward appearances, they seem to be handling it about as well as you could hope, even though they lost this game.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think also, it's like, I think you can't judge them based on one game in this period of time. I think, you know, they've also been struggling as a team since before that, honest, or the last, I don't know, however many couple games, even during the Bruce investigation, when Richie was interim coach. I mean, they dropped points in consecutive games and basically the last kick of the ball. And then, you know, came out last night, and also another poor performance. So that kind of transcends, I think, the crisis within the club. I think those are two separate things. And yeah, I think that on that level, you know, they've handled it as well as they can. Granted, we haven't really heard or seen too much of them in that time. We finally heard from Carlos, and I know, some of my reporter colleagues who were at practice last week finally got to talk to some players as well. I think like Farrell. And so, you know, they've said all the right things, and they seem to be doing all the right things. So yeah, I mean, you know, they're handling it as best as they can.
Yeah, I think credit to the players for maybe not, at least yet, showing this as a complete collapse of the team's unity and everything. But yeah, I mean, a lot has happened this past week. I mentioned at the beginning, Richie Williams was named the interim coach. Well, it sounded like for the remainder of the season, and then it turned out that, you know, Brian Bolello said, actually, no, he was never told he was going to be the interim head coach for the remainder of the season. And then they appointed Clint Pied as the interim head coach. And Richie Williams was now given some time off. And none of that, reading between the lines, is too surprising when you saw the Athletic reporting. And it came out that Richie Williams was, at least according to the Athletic, was one of the people that had complained about Bruce Arena, and that was part of the investigation. And there were a lot of players on this team that had come out in support of Bruce Arena. Bruce Arena's got a lot of fans, both on the coaching staff and within the team. And because there really hasn't been much transparency, at least that we're aware of, either for us or for the players, from what we've heard, unless they're keeping it close to the vest as far as what happened, it's not too surprising that some players were frustrated with, hey, Richie Williams is part of the reason this coach is gone, most likely, and we don't even know what was said that was enough to get this coach to be gone. You know, do we trust this guy, especially if he can't be transparent with us about what actually happened? So that, I don't know about you, but it was not surprising that they had to move on from Richie Williams. They probably took too long to do it, right? Because they had these meetings on Tuesday that didn't go well, obviously.
I mean, you know, anytime you have a guy who comes out and does a press conference, and then 24 hours later, you have another press conference with, you know, club officials talking about why that guy is no longer in charge, you know, and that first press conference was supposed to be the one that was supposed to, you know, answer questions. This coming after you had canceled the media appearance after the last game in which you had bizarrely announced at full time the resignation of your longtime head coach. I mean, it was symptomatic of just a disastrous series of events for them. I don't think you can really, without knowing all the details, what I do get the sense of is that the club, at least, is not just blaming Richie Williams for this. I think they, you know, tried to not necessarily side with him, but just sort of acknowledge that, like, okay, that was a mistake, we had to replace him, but we're also not, you know, he wasn't gone for the club. He's just sort of like on a break or whatever they were saying. They were saying that, you know, he's going to take some time off, I guess. It's just such a bizarre series of events that I do agree that, you know, based on the reporting that we saw from the Athletic, phenomenal work from you know, those guys over there, Tom and Pablo, great reporting. They I think those two reports honestly drove both of the news announcements. You know, their report on that Saturday, I don't know if that led to maybe Bruce's decision led to more of it, but it was like that led to the announcement on Saturday night. And then the report on Tuesday about the, you know, the strife within the squad, about the, you know, the reported incident of a fight between Shawry Joseph and Richie Williams in 2022. That all came out on Tuesday afternoon. And that, I felt like, precipitated the club making that change that night. So yeah, it was like they were reactive to all this. And I think when I asked Brian Bolello about it at the press conference on Wednesday, he said that essentially without saying it. He didn't acknowledge the Athletic reports or any of that being the reason for it, but he said, we were reactive in all of this, and you don't want to be in that position as a club. He kept saying that though, like, we were reacting to all of this. And that really did sum it up. They were just reacting to events instead of trying to get ahead of events. And anytime that happens to you in any level, in any organization, I think that's going to be a recipe for not necessarily disaster, but just sort of, I don't know, being behind the eight ball there.
Yeah, and WK Sapolno on Twitter says, my question is, what's the over-under on number of games before Revolution President Brian Bilello is fired or resigns? And I think that brings me to a comment or a question for you and a comment that I want to make, and that is, do you think this could have been handled better? Obviously, it was a very, very tough situation for anyone to be put in, but do you think this could have been handled better by the Revolution front office? Because to me, the situation on Tuesday, you know, based on what we knew, was somewhat predictable that Richie Williams was going to run into, you know, some players, coaching staff, whatever, that, you know, wasn't happy with how things went down. And speaking of Brian Bilello saying he was, you know, reactive instead of proactive because he had to be, my one, you know, it's hard to say too much without, you know, again, knowing what happened. But my one thought is, you know, assuming you agree with me that it was somewhat predictable the reaction to Richie Williams was going to go the way it did, should Brian Bilello have come out, if he was still on board with Richie Williams and wanted to keep him, and done a press conference on Tuesday, sat beside Richie Williams and say, he did the right thing, we support him fully? You know, he was putting him in a very tough position to put him out there, you know, Tuesday by himself, you know, given everything that had happened. And to me, that was a situation where if you wanted to keep Richie Williams as the interim head coach, and at that point, you know, he was the interim head coach, it would have made sense for Brian Bilello or Kurt Knoefel or both to go out there and say, you know, we can't really talk about everything that happened, but Richie Williams did the right thing. We want to keep him here. He has our support. And that, to me, is the one thing that doesn't quite sit right, is that they waited till the next day when they moved on from him to give their press conference. And otherwise, you know, Bilello and Knoefel were, you know, weren't doing media until the day after that all went down.
Yeah, I mean, and summarized the reactiveness to all of that was that they only got out there themselves after it had, the stuff had totally hit the fan and they had to make another change. You know, their third head coaching, you know, head coach, interim coach in that case, of the week. It's hard to say what they should and shouldn't have done without knowing, like, I guess essentially what they can and can't say about the investigation in a legal sense, maybe, or in a sense of, you know, I don't know what sort of secrecy they were officially sworn to or not. But I understand in terms of an investigation, you're trying to protect people and their anonymity who maybe have been the, you know, on the receiving end of some sort of abuse. And the league said that they confirmed some of those allegations against Bruce Arena, though, of course, they didn't say what allegations or really offer any sort of detail on that front. And that was part of the players' frustrations. But yeah, I mean, it was fairly predictable from the team standpoint that, especially once those reports emerged, that your interim head coach had maybe been one of the guys who had filed complaints, that the players, who by all accounts were very loyal to Bruce Arena, had questions about that. And that once you couldn't answer those questions, it should have been foreseeable that there was going to be a growing level of unacceptable frustration from the players at that point. So yeah, I mean, it's a tough one because it's so like unprecedented that there's really no playbook for it. And it really seemed like the Revs were struggling in that, you know, they normally, you know, from a public relations standpoint, at least have like some procedures that they try to follow there, but there was no procedure for that. So they were kind of just improvising and they did not improvise in the best way. I agree that, you know, maybe it would have been better if more official club representation had been in that Tuesday press conference where you just put your interim head coach out there acting as if it was just any other media availability, kind of like, all right, well, here's our guy. And then maybe we'll have a player afterwards. Of course, Carlos was immediately announced as having, you know, he was not available. It was just going to be Brian, which was sort of a early indication that maybe there was some larger issue in the club, as we now know at that point, that they weren't training, whether it was a player's decision or a collective decision, as they said it was. But yeah, I think, I don't know if it would have made a difference, but it probably would have been a better call, at least in the short term, to just try to have some solidarity within the club if Bilello and maybe Knoefel had appeared on that Tuesday press conference as well, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know what would have made a difference either, but I think it would have looked better and showed more of a united front than what we saw. So just one last question I wanted to ask you, because I had my own thoughts on it, is, you know, we haven't really seen ownership's presence while this is going on. It's been a very troubling time for the team. Lots of chaos. You know, we talked about keeping this team unified. As far as we're aware, you know, Jonathan Kraft, Robert Kraft, I haven't really said anything to the team. And, you know, there was all those meetings on Tuesday, and it seems like that might have been helpful if, you know, they showed some presence and stepped in and, you know, kind of showed that they were there for the team. And maybe I'm thinking too much, but do you think that's something that, you know, could have helped if, you know, Jonathan Kraft had been involved in any of these meetings? And maybe he was, but I don't think so from what we've heard.
Yeah, I think it could have helped. I think it would not have totally, from what we have heard and what I think they still would have done as a club in managing this past week, in terms of not really talking about the investigation and offering kind of a minimal amount of details about internal decisions within the club, I don't think any of that would have changed, but I think it's still, yeah, I think, as you said, it kind of would have helped add some, a little more just sort of top down legitimacy in terms of unified front across the club if ownership was there, because we don't normally see the Crafts involved with any sort of Revs announcements or Revs related anything, to be honest. So that absolutely would have added something to it. And the fact that we didn't see that, I think, was kind of another sign of just they didn't really know how to handle it. And it seemed like it was just sort of done a little bit haphazardly. And I know that there were unprecedented circumstances involved with that. And so, as we were saying, there really was no real playbook for it. But yeah, it would have helped if we'd seen Jonathan Kraft this week, for sure.
And a good way to wrap up the listener comments, Mike from New Hampshire says, why us? Hayden, with that, any final thoughts? And do you have anything coming up in the Globe? And where else can people find you on social media?
You can still find me on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it these days, at Hayden H. Bird. And you can find my work on Boston.com. Just had my takeaways from last night's game go up, or from Saturday night's game, depending on when you're listening to this. That just went up, so that's available, along with a bunch of different news from the past week about the club. And you can always find my work there. It's been great to be here. I think that it's always great to talk about this team, and I love covering it, but it's just been such a difficult week for the club as a whole. And then this result just kind of compounds on it. But even still, I would just leave everyone with the fact that they're still, at this moment anyway, in third place in the Eastern Conference. And while they are beset by numerous issues, you look at where Colorado is, having just gone through a similar thing of having replaced their coach yet again. They're in last place. The Reds are in third place. So you could still spin this in a positive way. If you're the team, you just need to be able to find a way to start getting results.
Hayden, thanks so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. To wrap things up, I do want to give a quick shout out to my favorite story in New England soccer right now, which is my Bryant men's soccer team. As an alumni of the school, very happy to see them 6-0-0 to start the season, yet to see a goal. They hired Ruben Resende as the former Franklin Pierce coach who won the national title last year and have been doing a fantastic job so far this year. So if you're looking for a positive New England soccer story to watch, that's a good one to keep track of. You can follow me on Twitter at Sean Aldonio, and of course follow the podcast on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, even at Revolution Recap. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Be sure to check out our friends at the Blazing Musket. Thanks again for listening to Revolution Recap, presented by BetOnline, and we'll be back after the next game with another podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.